is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
When your fire truck is so old, you can attach club plates and have a collector's item. We'll speak to the Small Rural Fire Brigade, who are doing just that today on the program. Plus, we will have a look at the long wait for sheep producers to get a foot rot vaccine, with some details on that coming for you, and a massive wine fine. Details on that coming from just across the border today on the Country Hour. Plus, I'd love your involvement in the program. You can send a text 0467 842 722 or give us a call 1300 977 222. This is the Country Hour. Warwick Long with you. Plenty coming up today.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Let's go to the northwest, where CFA volunteers from a Small Rural Fire Brigade have affixed vintage registration plates to their 33-year-old truck in protest over the age of the truck and the lack of funding for rural brigades. They believe rural brigades are being chronically underfunded, and they say the inequity between metropolitan and rural fire services has widened since Fire Rescue Victoria took control of the CFA in 2020. Leonard Valance is an Oyen farmer and member of the Midiac Fire Brigade. He says members are exasperated over ageing resources, and those resources are now so old they qualify for club plates.
We had our annual meeting at the Midiac fire shed last night, and we were sitting there looking at the fire truck, and one of the members got the service book out, and the truck had first been serviced in 1991. So we decided it was about time the fire truck got put on club plates, because you have to be 25 years old to go on club plates. So we grabbed a set of club plates and put them on our fire truck.
So your truck's 33 years old then?
Yep, effectively. So we just wonder how long we're going to go before we actually get a new truck. This is getting to the ridiculous stage in rural Victoria.
Have you had any communication from head office about when a new truck might be in the pipeline?
We've been on the list for probably 10 years, so we're still waiting.
And the truck that you've got, I mean, is it fit for purpose being that old?
Not really, not in this modern era, no. The truck's not air-conditioned. It has no water facilities on it for consumption of the members on the truck. And it's just an old truck. So as we all know, old trucks become unreliable, fires are dangerous, and we need equipment that people are safe to use in a difficult situation.
Things like joining strike teams, going away to fight fires, is that out of the question with the truck that old?
Oh, definitely. The truck wouldn't make it, no doubt about that.
What's the sentiment in your brigade about the direction of the CFA?
They think it's gone over the cliff. We've just been forgotten about. And our brigade is, Midiac is based on the Calder Highway, so we attend motor vehicle accidents a number of times during the year. Then there's Calder Highway fire started from brakes and faulty wheel bearings. And also attached to that, we have haystack fires to attend, and various machinery fires on farms during the year, during harvest and other times. So the brigade is fairly active brigade.
Another common complaint I hear from CFA members, apart from lack of upgrades to equipment and trucks, is just the bureaucracy and red tape that's required to jump through to be a member these days?
It's silly. Being in a rural fire brigade is a fairly simple equation. We go there to put the wet stuff on the hot stuff, and to complicate it with bureaucracy and make it difficult for the members is counterproductive to the community as a whole.
What's it been like since CFA, or at least the paid division of CFA, was absorbed into FRV, Fire Rescue Victoria?
We've just seen a further decline in the service provided. I mean, the age of the truck's a classic. I mean, that should have been replaced years ago. And we don't even look like as though we're anywhere near the top of the list now.
So is money, or state government money that's spent on fire response, is that not making it out to the regions then?
Not to places like Midiac, it's not, no.
So what do you do? Where to from here?
We thought we'd be topical and put the club plates on it. Perhaps the minister might notice, look up the map, see where Northwest Victoria is for a start, find Midiac, then realise that we are important to the community and we have a role here to play to keep the community safe. Perhaps they might like to care about that sometime.
Midiac's 33-year-old truck, is that an exception or are there other trucks that old getting around?
I think there would be other trucks if you had a look around the state that are just as old as this one. People are just sick of it. There seems to be money for everything else, but not for the real things.
That's Owen Farmer and Midiac Fire Brigade member Leonard Vallance speaking there with Angus Verley. Of course, we've contacted the Emergency Services Minister, Jacqueline Symes, for comment. Haven't got anything back yet. If you're a CFA member, though, Regional Victoria, listening to this, how old's your truck? Send us a text anonymously. I'd be really interested to know. 33-year-old truck, is that the oldest truck in Regional Victoria or are there older ones out there? Send us a text 0467 842 722. How old's your fire truck? That's a question I thought I'd never ask. 0467 842 722 to send us a text on the Country Hour. I'd love to know how old that fire truck is that you're using at the moment. It's 11 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Let's talk irrigators in Sunraysia who have slammed a decision by Lower Murray Water to appoint people to its advisory committees rather than have them democratically elected. Lower Murray Water argues that the election process isn't working because an election hasn't been required for a decade due to insufficient nominees. But Frank DeMarzi, the last chair of the Strategic Advisory Committee, says it defeats the purpose of having an advisory committee, especially if they're appointed by the people they're meant to advise.
Well, the changes are that Lower Murray Water has seen fit to do away with the democratic principle in the customer committees of its districts. And as chair of the Strategic Advisory Committee, I'm bound to pass on the committee's thoughts to Lower Murray Water that they're going down the wrong track. They are now going through the process of advertising to fill the positions on the committees, but they want to vet and basically choose the people that they want through a closed process, and that's not good enough. I mean, this district was established on the democratic principle dating back to the Chafees. Our committees are only advisory committees, but they're the only way that people that produce wealth in the district, the irrigators, have a chance to have a say in water policy in this region and in this area. We've made submissions to them leading up to a couple of weeks ago, and they've chosen to just go down the track that they want to. Now, because no one on the elected committees representing the interests of irrigators have agreed with the changes that they're proposing and are making, bad decisions will be made from if they appoint people that don't represent the interests of irrigators.
One of the reasons that they gave us for change was to do with not enough people putting their hand up to go on the committee. What were your thoughts on this?
They're now going to the process of social media advertising. Well, why didn't they do that before they disbanded the elected committees? They could have done that before and ascertained whether they were going to get recipients or not. And in fact, I don't understand why they've gone down this track. I suspect I know. Probably because we had the cheek to invite the Essential Services Commission to their pricing changes last year, where they put through basically a 7% price increase. We saw that as unfair and unwarranted given the circumstances that people were facing out there in the irrigation community. And I don't think that the board appreciated that. And that's probably the main reason, I suspect, as to why they're doing what they're doing. But putting that aside, we need to move forward and find the best people to go on those committees through an election process. That's my firm view and the committee's firm view.
That's the outgoing chair of the Strategic Advisory Committee, Frank DeMarzi, who's not happy Lower Murray Water will now appoint that advisory committee rather than elect them. Lower Murray Water Managing Director Paul Northey has defended his authority's decision to do away with elections and instead select committee members from among those who chose to nominate.
Simple fact is we just haven't been getting enough people to put up their hands to stand for a public election to go on the committee. So we're looking at trying to simplify the process, make it easier, maybe make it a little bit less daunting, and just simply going through a simple process of filling out a nomination form going that's available on our website. And, looking at trying to get a full committee, but also trying to get some new people on the committee and some different voices as well. I mean, I think the other thing, Andrew, is running an election is resource intensive. You know, we have to engage an electoral officer, there's resources involved. And I think, as you said just before, the last few times that we've run elections, we haven't had to end up running them because we just haven't had enough people who have wanted to stand for election.
I guess the obvious criticism of that is who's then picking the advisory committee? Because if I was getting someone to review my radio show, I'd pick my mum, my grandma and my dad to be on the review committee. So who's going to be picking who's on this advisory committee for Lower Murray Water?
Yeah, so firstly, the nominations process hasn't closed. It closes next 5th of April. So it's been running since late February. In terms of selection committee, we're looking at having a board director, myself, a industry representative and an independent panel member. So we're trying to be, you know, as open and make it as broad as you like. And it's certainly not about just trying to pick people who, we just want to hear, they'll say the things that we want to hear. Quite the opposite. What's the point of having an advisory committee that does that? So it's really, as I said, trying to broaden it out, trying to get as many people as possible to put their hand up, and then we'll run the process and hopefully we get a really vibrant and full committee.
Do you kind of see the criticism, though, that if the board and yourself and whoever else is on the committee picks you for this role, then I kind of feel like my obligation is to you. But if it was my fellow irrigators who picked me for the role, I feel like my obligation is to them and to serve their best interests. And I think that's some of the criticism that Frank and Greg were putting forward. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, the committees are to provide advice to the board, as everyone said, and, you know, the board makes the ultimate decisions. But there's no point having a vacuum of groupthink or anything along those lines. That's, and as far as I'm concerned, and being on the selection panel, that's not what I'll be looking for. I'll be looking for a variety of voices and views and from right across our rural irrigation sector. Frank and Greg, I've had several conversations with this on the past, and I'd welcome their nomination. And, certainly they've put forward some different views over time, and that's perfectly okay. That's what the process is all about. So absolutely not about just trying to get people that we want to hear. It's about people who have different ideas, want to bring forward different points, and let's have an open discussion within the committee and bring forward some really strong and robust advice to our board.
Trust us. That's the message from Lower Murray Water. It's Managing Director Paul Northey speaking there with Andrew Murdoch. It's 17 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Hey, look, it was an obscure talkback question. It's really good information, though, that you're providing us with at the Country Hour right now. I am asking, how old's your CFA truck? How old is your fire truck? Because one's 33 years old, qualifies for club plates. And many of you wanting to have your say on that. Let's read some of your texts right now. If the fire truck's been looked after and maintained, it should be as good as it's ever been in the service, says one text. Kevin says, beautiful day at Myrtleford, little bit smoky from the controlled burns in the northeast. Happy Easter to everyone. Oh, not on fire trucks, but a good message anyway. Kevin, thank you. I totally agree about the CFA. Rural brigades are totally missing out since Fire Rescue Victoria was created. We will never get another member with current regime. It's ridiculous. Money's being wasted in so many areas by FRV that don't help us fight fires, says Hayden, a CFA captain who says, I think our truck's about 29 years old. Craig says, Woz, this is one of the reasons, along with our overburdening bureaucracy since the introduction of the Fire Services Victoria, why I am no longer a member of the ever-shrinking CFA. Good segment on the Fire Brigade, a critical subject for rural areas. The minister hasn't replied because they're at lunch using fire brigade funds, says this text. Julian at Mudgeegonga says, last year we upgraded our 1966 Bedford with a 1986 Unimog, says Julian at Mudgeegonga. Two trucks in our group are over 35 years old, says another one. District 11 has a few old ones. Mossy, Tambo, Flag Creek, Ben Warden, at least 30 years old. All early 1990s models, says Chris. And look, there's a lot more coming in. We'll continue fire truck talk back here on the Country Hour because, as I say, this is interesting information. Let us know how old your fire truck is. 0467 842 722. Julian says, whoops, I missed a qualifier about being a CFA truck. So I think the Unimog's Julian's personal fire truck. That's good information all the same, Julian. Thank you for providing that. I'm glad I saw that text come through nice and quickly. Let's talk power lines right now, though, on the country. The Nationals member for Gippsland South says the state government has been too slow in addressing community concerns about a proposed transmission line route. Last week, the Government Planning Agency for Offshore Wind Projects, VicGrid, announced a potential overhead route spanning 6 kilometres from Gifford to the Latrobe Valley in Gippsland, the second proposed power corridor in the region. On the country hour, you heard from VicGrid Chief Executive Alistair Parker about whether the impacts on agriculture were considered, and this is a little of what he had to say.
So we've taken into account a whole load of factors in this, trying to minimise impacts on landholders, communities, the environment, keeping down costs for consumers. We've tried to avoid major townships. This particular study area has a lower proportion of agricultural and private land than most of our other options. And it also allows us to explore alignment with the existing Basslink route. There may be technical reasons why we can't do that, but at least we can have a look at it.
How many landholders would be affected under this proposed route?
Yeah, so it's not a route yet. It's a study area, but across the study area, there are about 300 landholders. And before we've done this announcement, we've tried to get in touch with all of them over the course of the last week. But so we recognise, you know, this can be confronting information, and we're just helping people work through that.
That is the head of VicGrid, Alistair Parker, speaking on the Country Hour last week. But Nationals member for Gippsland South, Danny O'Brien, says the decision has left much of the Gippsland community concerned and confused, and he's frustrated by the length in time it's taking to get this information to the community.
Look, there's a number of responses. I think certainly concern from the community, which would prefer to see any transmission line go underground, and obviously the government's announcing an above-ground route. I think there's a level of uncertainty too, in that we've had AusNet working for the last probably 2.5 years on an alternate route to the one that's now been announced, and there's many people probably happy that they're no longer subject to the proposal, given that the government's gone with a different area than AusNet. But at the same time, it probably creates a little bit more uncertainty because there's a whole new group of people now potentially subject to this this alignment, and that's going to cause some angst for quite some time yet.
And so you mentioned that there have been plans for this transmission line for a while now, but how much consultation has actually been going on in the community?
Well, there's been a fair bit by AusNet and VicGrid to some degree, but I think probably my criticism is that the government's been a bit slow to act on this, and that's led to a level of confusion and uncertainty in the public, because AusNet got out with a commercial proposal, a private commercial proposal, and that's caused a bit of confusion in the community now, particularly with a government agency in VicGrid coming forward with a different alternate route altogether. There does need to be, though, a lot more consultation, particularly given that this particular study area is going to involve people that weren't part of what AusNet was looking at, and therefore we're almost starting from scratch, and I think that raises some issues as well.
And so you said that it has taken a while. So what are we talking about in terms of the timeline?
Well, I think it's, you know, as I said, 2.5 years or more that AusNet's been developing their proposal. And we had the government put out an offshore wind implementation statement more than 2 years ago that indicated that there would be an overhead power line through the area. VicGrid was established about the same time. And yet here we are, you know, 2.5 years, 2 years down the track. We're just getting a study area, and indeed legislation only passed introduced in the Parliament last week to give powers to AusGrid, to VicGrid in this respect. So there's a delay here where the government is perhaps slower than it needs to be, and that's going to cause confusion and uncertainty for people, particularly those people who don't want the transmission lines and particularly would like to see them underground.
So you mentioned the 300 or so landholders that may be affected by this transmission line route. They're concerned about the route itself and the suddenness of this announcement. But what else are you hearing from them?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. What's been announced is an area, a study area, rather than an actual route. So there's whilst there's some 300 people have received letters from VicGrid, the actual route will be considerably less than that impacted. And I think what we're talking about too is an area that was subject to a very long fight over the Basslink cable that came through from Tasmania 20, 25 years ago, and it's virtually the same route. Now, there's some advantages in doing that, but again, it's picking off a scab with the local community that fought a very strong campaign against pylons 25 years ago, and now they're faced with the same. And not only that, they're faced with the same now, but the prospect of a second and even third transmission line going forward, if indeed the entire government target of offshore wind goes ahead, because one cable simply will not be enough.
And VicGrid has said that this region, this study area, has a lower proportion of agricultural and private land than other areas. So what do you say to that?
Look, I do acknowledge that, and I absolutely support what VicGrid and the government are trying to do in limiting what they call, you know, spaghetti effect of dozens of different cables. So that's in principle correct, and certainly this alignment would indicate some benefits in that respect, less farmland, less private land ownership. So it's not only following the Basslink alignment in a rough sense, but also a lot of it through HVP plantations. So I certainly don't oppose that, but it's the uncertainty and the delays that's been a concern. And now we've got a whole new group of people who will potentially be impacted by this, and they need to go through that consultation phase as well.
That's Danny O'Brien, Nationals member for Gippsland South, speaking with Faith Tabaluyan. And in a statement, VicGrid confirmed cost was a key reason for an overhead corridor, with their analysis showing undergrounding to cost between $2 and $4.5 billion compared to $700 million to $1.5 billion for overhead lines. So that's Gippsland. Let's talk about the moving of power routes for Southern New South Wales right now. Transgrid has altered the proposed route for the VNI West transmission line to move it further away from the Moolamine Township. The alterations in response to protests from local residents over the previous plan for the line to come within 2.5 kilometres of the centre of Moolamine. Local farmer China Gibson says whilst it's a positive note, there's still widespread opposition to the project.
That's good, because no one wants to look at it. A 70-metre tower right near town. And if we can keep it away from our town, it's much, much better.
So the plan is 6 kilometres from the township now. How close was it going to run to the town under the previous plan?
It got, well, one red herring scheme they had was about 1.5 kilometres from the post office. That wouldn't happen. The one they had planned last time was 2.5 kilometres from the post office, which is about 2 kilometres to the nearest townhouse and about 1 kilometre to the nearest house out north of town. So now it's 6 kilometres, is a lot better.
Why would they ever propose to go so close to the town? Because shouldn't they have foreseen that just wouldn't be acceptable by the residents?
For some reason, Moolamine only had a 2 kilometre zone around it. Like, every other town was 5 kilometres, Moolamine was 2. So it was still within their perceived where they could go. But they just keep throwing these things. Transgrid, I think they're just working the game. They put up the worst case scenarios, and we all go, no, you can't do that. So they go, oh, we'll be good boys, we'll go 6 kilometres from town. But they're run by the city slickers. They haven't got a clue.
Just to summarise, China, what are the attitudes toward the project in your part of the world?
Oh, no one wants it. Even the graziers out here don't really want it running through their grazing country. It's just, it's an eyesore. Then it's got to get from Moolamine to a place called Murrabit, end up in Kerrang. And that's through rice farms, through family farms, past houses. No one wants it. We don't want it in our district, but we've got it. They're coming through.
And the trade-off, China, the compensation that's on the table, is that attractive to anyone?
I'll take the money. This place could make millions out of it, the big station country. It's, you know, $200,000 a kilometre.
Okay, so with this change to the preferred route, moving it away from the town, is that going to get more people on side, or is that opposition going to remain?
No one's really on side. No one wants it. We've got it. It's coming through, I reckon. It's coming through. The blokes out next to me out here, station country, they don't want it through their place. They're dead against it. And they're not going to change attitude at all. They want it to go north up to the other power lines on the Hay Plains and join up with them. One other fella, he said, yeah, he can come through my place, but by geez, they're going to pay for it. Like, he doesn't want it. It's got to go right through over his sand hills, over his irrigation, and he can't grow rice there again. No one wants it.
That is China Gibson speaking there with Angus Verley about the change in route around Moolamine for the VNI West transmission line project there. 0467 842 722 if you want to send us a text. Many of you are doing it. Over the age of your fire truck, I've been asking how old's your fire truck. Here's a couple more. Samaria Fire Brigade between Benalla and Mansfield. The tanker is 31 years old. No replacement date ever provided despite numerous requests. Very hard to recruit new members when all we can offer is an antiquated and fundamentally unsafe truck. Many other trucks of similar age are still in use in the region as well. Yeah, and this from Rob, you don't see our Polly's getting around in a 1991 EB Ford Falcon, do you? Midiac Brigade have probably just put themselves on the bottom of the list now, says Rob, which is sad as well, isn't it? Thanks for your text. Let's get some rural news right now. Faith Tabaluyan has that for us again today. Hi, Faith.
Afternoon, Woz. The South Australian government says it's concerned by a Victorian government announcement to ban wild dog control on private and public land in the northwest of the state. South Australia has invested significant amounts of money in rebuilding the wild dog fence in the state and is concerned about an increase in wild dog predation if dogs and dingoes are protected along its border. Minister for Primary Industries, Claire Scriven, says she'll be asking Victoria for more information.
The real concern around the decision that's been taken in northwest Victoria is the significant impact it can have on South Australia. So that's what we're working through at the moment. We'll reach out again to the Victorian government. But it's also worth mentioning that I understand that the Victorian decision does allow for some exemptions. So we probably need some more detail around that as well. But certainly it is a concern. It's a large concern. And I'll be working with agencies and Dog Fence Board and others here in South Australia to see what we can do to protect our very important livestock industry.
Heading up north, more than 100 cattle from the Northern Territory died while on a ship to Indonesia this month. And it looks like botulism may have been the cause, although investigations are still to be completed. The cattle have been linked to a property in the NT, where other cattle have died as well. The NT's chief vet, Rob Williams, says testing will continue to find a definitive cause.
Yeah, since the mortality event was reported on the boat, we were investigating since last week a mortality event in the Northern Territory that may or may not be related to the boat. So the team's been busy taking samples and making sure that we process the samples through the laboratory as a high priority. But one of the things I probably urge is a little bit of caution around the diagnosis at this stage, because we're still working through that. And just to probably emphasise, there is no suspicion of either foot and mouth or lumpy skin disease.
Tasmanian farmers looking to send livestock over to Melbourne are facing long delays, with more cattle trailers stuck on the mainland than those going back. Jeff Page ships livestock across the Bass Strait and says while bottlenecks like this aren't frequent, dry conditions may drag this one out.
We haven't had this amount of stock to move in March for, I think, going back probably about 8 or 9 years since we had the last really dry spell. But coupled with the demand from King Island, which we last week we did 27 loads from King Island mainland to mainland Australia and also to mainland Tasmania. And so that takes out another heap of trailers. Look, at the moment, we pretty well booked up for the next month.
Dairy cooperative Norco has exported its first shipment of ice cream since the 2022 catastrophic floods shut its factory in Lismore, New South Wales. The processing plant, located on the banks of the Wilson River, reopened last November after a $100 million rebuild. Federal Minister for Agriculture Murray Watt says it's great news for region rebuilding after extensive flooding.
That's left Brisbane and it's actually due to arrive in Japan sometime this week. So it's fantastic news to see those international markets reopening for Lismore. That means jobs for Lismore workers. That means jobs and economic growth to the Northern Rivers as a whole.
Prawn trawlers are on their way to the Gulf of Carpentaria for the banana prawn season, which kicks off on Easter Monday. The industry is hoping to make some better money this year after a challenging 2023 season, which saw bumper catch numbers but very poor prices. Michael O'Brien from Australia Bay Seafoods says the boats are raring to go.
We have about, I think it's about 16 boats out of Darwin leading up to the 1st of April and the start of the banana season, which under the NPF this year is going to be a little bit different. The big push this year is on quality. All the companies have got different approaches how they were going to achieve this. But I think this year will be the year you see the best of the quality and the banana prawn out of the Gulf of Carpentaria or the northern prawn fisheries.
And a cheese made from raw sheep's milk has won the 17th President's Medal at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. Pecora Dairy won Australia's most prestigious food prize for a semi-hard cheese called Yarrawa, which is the indigenous name for the rainforest area on their New South Wales property. Cressida Kane says it's a big win for the recently legalised raw milk cheese industry in Australia.
We were the first, yeah, so it's an incredibly exciting honour to have, but we live in Robertson in the most beautiful part of New South Wales with incredibly high rainfall and also amazing ecosystem. We have lyrebirds, we have wallabies, we have echidnas on our farm, so to be able to have that combination of factors that are able to be shown in our raw milk cheese is something that's really special.
So, Woz, it might be sheep's milk cheese and chocolate on the Easter menu. And that wraps up Rural News.
Raw sheep's milk cheese. Look, I'll try anything once, and this sounds like award-winning cheese, so it's probably an expensive thing to try once, but still sounds pretty good to me. I'm asking you today, how old's your fire truck? There is a fire truck out there so old it could have club plates, could have the heritage plates on it, and in fact, many of your fire trucks are the same. Will says the Miranatwa truck. I'll probably stuff that pronunciation up, Will, but he says that's 34 years old. We might have a leader in the clubhouse there. Longford Tank is 25 years old, says another text as well. All you guys can be getting the club plates for your trucks as well. Keep them coming, 0467 842 722. Also, I have some texts on the weather, particularly looking at if any rain is going to eventuate early next week. Joanna Hughes can probably take us through some of those details today. Send your forecaster at the Weather Bureau. G'day.
G'day, Warwick. How are you today?
I'm good. How's it looking around Victoria? We better start today and then we'll work into the weekend. So pretty fine and settled today?
Yeah, that's right. So I've been pretty cloudy around southern parts this morning, but that cloud is starting to break up now. And there's a fair few planned burns around, particularly in northeast Victoria at the moment. So a little bit of smoke that I can see on the satellite at the moment, but otherwise pretty well settled conditions and a little bit of a chilly start for the northeast this morning, sort of getting those minimums down to 3 or 4 degrees in some parts, but Nothing too dramatic there. As we're heading into the long weekend, things are looking to be a little bit warmer tomorrow. It's fairly cool, temperatures slightly below average for the state today, but it's starting to warm up from tomorrow as the high that's sort of sitting in the Bight at the moment is moving eastwards over Bass Strait this evening and into the Tasman and turning those winds a bit more northerly as we head into the start of the long weekend. So things warming up a little bit, fairly sort of warm to mild in the south and a little bit hotter up in the north over the weekend. And we may very well see some morning cloud and a little bit of fog around the south as well for both Saturday and Sunday. The chance of a few showers up in the very far northwest, just some isolated sort of hit or miss showers or possibly some storms up there. So can't really promise how much you might see in the gauge for any particular location. It's that sort of situation where you might see something pop up, you know, down the road but not get anything in your area. So that's for Sunday. And then it's as we're heading into the start of next week that I'm sure people who are clued in and having a look are interested in what's going to happen.
Yeah, and it's been fairly uncertain, hasn't it? I was speaking to Bri yesterday for this cross, and she gave a big sigh about the uncertainty and said, oh, tropical moisture, trying to work it out has been difficult. Has that cleared up a little bit to start next week?
Look, it's still, you know, playing a bit of a trickster game with us at the moment. So it's looking a little bit more consistent in the most recent model runs that we've had through, but who knows what it'll do in the next one, but I'll tell you the story as it stands anyway, and just with a caveat that they may very well change again with whoever you're speaking to tomorrow. But yes, we do have this tropical moisture that's sort of sitting over New South Wales through Sunday, and that's when we may get those showers and storms up in the far northwest of the state. On Monday, that that moisture may very well get drawn down a little bit further over Victoria. So at the moment, it's looking like that trough associated with the moisture might deepen over western Victoria sort of in the latter half of the day and then start to move eastwards. And as it stands, it's looking like the wetter sort of conditions are expected overnight Monday and into Tuesday. So potentially some rain on the cards there. But it is looking to be more sort of focused through the usual spots sort of around the ranges and particularly the northeast ranges. And whether or not we get very much up in the northwest is always a bit of a question mark. But what we're looking at the moment in terms of totals with that, as I say, very, very well may change. Sort of looking at maybe a couple of millimetres in the gauge for the northwest more and sort of western districts more generally, most likely on the Monday. And then that sort of as it moves eastwards over into Tuesday and in the early hours of Tuesday morning, we may be seeing sort of in the 10 to 15 millimetre sort of ranges for eight parts of eastern Victoria and up to about 20 millimetres over the Alpine peaks. So those are kind of upper ends of what we're looking at the moment. But as Bri would have said yesterday, with the tropical moisture, it can come out and surprise us. So we'll be keeping our eye on that over the next few days as we hopefully those models start to come into alignment a little bit more. But yes, the general story is a bit of rainfall picking up most likely from later on Monday and continuing early into Tuesday morning. And then on Wednesday, it's an easing trend with just scattered showers sort of on and south of the ranges and remaining dry up in the north for Wednesday. And that sort of easing trend continuing into Thursday as well.
So it sounds like at least the people out camping this weekend will be likely packed up and on the way home before any substantial rain arrives. So
yes, hopefully, you know, I think, you know, maybe pack up a little bit early on Monday just to be sure. But in terms of the long weekend, that's looking mostly dry. And then, yes, we may see things pick up from later in the Monday and into the Tuesday.
Brilliant. Warnings-wise across the weekend, we won't have a country out tomorrow, obviously Good Friday too. So warnings-wise, is there anything we need to keep an eye out for?
Not for the weekend in terms of warnings. We'll just sort of wait and see what's happening with the rainfall coming on Monday, Tuesday, to see if there's anything required there. But all in all, looks like a quiet weekend.
Brilliant. Joe, thanks so much for the update. Really appreciate it.
No problem, Warwick. Have a good day.
Joanna Hughes there, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, giving you the full forecast. Well, what we know really has sounded tricky all week to try and predict what's going to happen early next week, so you'll have to keep an eye on it. And obviously, Country Air will be back Monday, broadcasting from Riola, the charity carnival. It's been going for yonks. It sounds like a really fun event. I've seen ads for it from when I was a really young fella. Now to a not-so-young fella, and I can't wait to finally go. I'll be at the Riola Charity Carnival Monday. If you're going to be there, come and say g'day. Should be a fun country hour. 0467 842 722 is also the text line. If you want to send us a text, I'm going to read some of yours about CFA tankers in just a moment. I should tell you right now, though, the ABC understands that the Prime Minister is going to be out on a vineyard in the New South Wales Hunter Valley this afternoon, where it's expected he's going to make an announcement about Chinese wine tariffs being removed. It looks like finally what we've been speaking about for a mighty long time when it comes to Chinese tariffs on Australian wine, there could be a major announcement on that this afternoon. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is expected to be at a New South Wales Hunter Valley vineyard this afternoon to make a major announcement on Chinese wine tariffs. When we know more, we'll obviously tell you more. Keep an eye on abc.net.au/rural across the weekend. I'm sure you'll get the information you need to know there or either on the radio. I've been asking how old your fire truck is. Here's some more of your texts. This one says, our fire truck's 33 years old. We were told 10 years ago we were going to get a new one and we're still waiting. At one stage, we had a faulty low water warning as well as a fuel issue, which caused the fire truck to stop at times. So potentially we could get stuck in a fire without water. There are no votes in the country. So all the money is going to go to keep the fire unions on board, says this text. Another one says, my fire service levy increased from $450 to $550 in 12 months. Where's all that money going? I believe we're paying far too much and there needs to be an inquiry into where the dollars are spent, cut costs and reprioritise expenses. Thanks, says Anonymous. And Deb at Barnawatha says, re outdated fire trucks, try their training videos. Many of them are 50 years old. Their poor volunteer trainers are stuck with outdated videos, continually having to clarify what the current procedure is. It's not as if we haven't had any fires of recent decades where a team could be deployed to create updated training videos, but all the money goes to city brigades, says Deb at Barnawatha. Axe Creek apparently has a 33-year-old fire truck. Morong has a 33-year-old fire truck as well. DMOs are doing a great job, says that text. I don't know what a DMO is. Thank you for sending that in, though, all the same. And fire truck, 1991, they're two-wheel drives. They're no longer fit for purpose, says another text coming in. Keep them coming. Tell us how old your fire truck is. 0467 842 722. Let's talk foot rot in sheep right now, though, on the Country Hour, where it is 12:45. Frustrated sheep farmers are waiting on the wheels of government and regulatory authorities to turn, and turn slowly, so they can get access to an Australian-developed foot rot vaccine that's been proved to be effective. Caller Rebecca Hamilton to the Country Hour put this on our radar on 1300 977 222 last week. Here's a little of what she said.
Foot rot vaccine that was available to the sheep industry 6 years ago, Australian researched, Australian manufactured, and our industry can't access it anymore. And I am asking, I've been on the phone to the Federal Ag Department and multiple others. We're making progress, but it's just a tool that we need in our toolkit.
Why can't you access it, Rebecca?
Well, look, there's a long history to it. 6 years ago, it was available. And it no longer is. You asked Murray what that. It's got to do with the APVMA. Everyone is keen to see it back in the hands of producers to provide effective foot rot control for sheep producers.
So I wanted to get an answer to this, at least as an opening. We'll continue to have a look at this vaccine as we move through the program. But I actually, apart from Riola on Monday, I'll be away next week on the country. I'll be doing a drive for our colleagues in ABC Radio Melbourne. So I wanted to bring something to you as soon as I could. This is the story of two vaccines, a commercially available Footvax vaccine and what growers like Rebecca want more access to, the custom foot rot vaccine. The custom vaccine was only approved in Australia for a short time, but in that time, growers saw major benefits and now they're calling for more. Adam Dawes is the General Manager of Wool Producers Australia. He explains what the custom vaccine is and what the holdup is on getting it approved.
Yeah, the vaccine was developed by Sydney University. Basically, the vaccine is made up with antigens that are responsive to one or two of the serogroups of the foot rot bacteria. And the vaccine is made up according to what serogroups of foot rot are present on a particular property at a given time. So in order for producers to have used the vaccine in the past, they undertake foot swabbing. Those samples go off to Sydney Uni. The serogroups that are present on farm are identified, and then effectively a custom vaccine is made up to suit the circumstances of individual growers.
So this is a way to target the foot rot on an individual property. There are a lot of different types of foot rot. Through testing, you discover which one it is, and this is a vaccine to attack that type of foot rot.
Yeah, absolutely. The alternative vaccine, the Footvax vaccine, is a what they call a multivalent vaccine. So it's made up to respond to a higher number of the serogroups of foot rot. However, this custom foot rot vaccine is made up to just specifically target one or two. And in most cases, that invokes a stronger immune response when the vaccine's targeted to just one or two serogroups.
So this vaccine's there. It was developed by Sydney University. A company now has the rights to this vaccine. There were some approvals for it, but it's not anymore. Can you explain what's happened there?
Yes. So what we saw is in the years leading up to 2020, the multivalent vaccine wasn't available in the Australian market. There was a need to resolve some issues in relation to federal biosecurity import permits.
So the alternative, the one that covers seven types of foot rot, that alternative vaccine wasn't available in the market for a short time.
Yeah, that's right. And as a result of that, APVMA issued an emergency use permit for the custom foot rot vaccine because there was no other product available to deal with foot rot in the vaccine sense. So what we saw was a return to market of the Footvax vaccine in late 2020, was around about September, October, which resulted in a non-renewal of the emergency use permit. So we saw the return of the Footvax vaccine and the removal through non-permitting of the custom vaccine.
So the custom vaccine, this Australian-developed one, was effectively not approved for use anymore because this other commercial product was back in the market. Were growers or industry, are you frustrated by that, losing access to this vaccine?
Yeah, I think certainly what we had was very positive experiences from growers that used the custom vaccine up until its removal from market in 2020. We have made, as in Wool Producers Australia, have made a number of approaches to various ministers, DAF and APVMA officials expressing our frustrations. And initially we were seeking the reinstigation of an emergency use permit on the basis that, yes, both the custom vaccine and the Footvax vaccine deal with the same bacteria, but their on-farm use and their on-farm outcomes are quite different to one another, so they're not, in fact, actually equal products. We started to see that there was an inability to obtain an emergency use permit. So throughout 2021 and 2022, discussions took place with APVMA to look at other pathways, and they were trying to get a permit under a minor use permit pathway. However, we saw towards the end of 2022 that it became apparent that that wasn't available and full registration was required. And we certainly, from a wool producer's perspective, respect the role that regulators play in making sure that we have effective, efficient products and we can also pass on safe products to our consumers. However, the frustrating point that we've got is that Australian wool growers and sheep meat producers had access to a very effective vaccine up until late 2020, upon which time, due to changes in permitting at both the DAF biosecurity level and the APVMA emergency use permit level, we lost access. My understanding is that the manufacturing process and ingredients haven't changed, so the safety level is unchanged. However, the permitting processes are effectively what has removed the custom vaccine from the growers' foot rot arsenal.
So this is almost a wheels of government issue at the moment. You're waiting for the APVMA and the manufacturer of the vaccine to effectively talk to each other and go through the process of approval. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we do recognise that there were relatively low sales volumes. So it's not a substantially appealing product, I guess, in terms of a commercial sense. Otherwise, someone would pick this up and run with it. It's something that's quite necessary for growers to help manage foot rot. And on that point, wool producers convened a series of meetings throughout November and December last year where we brought together key producers, RDCs, DAF, APVMA, state farming organisations and the manufacturer and the University of Sydney to talk about pathways we can open up to get registration progressing again. And those meetings resulted in three quite tangible, clear actions that need to happen in sequential order. So the first being APVMA committed to undertake a gap analysis of information that they had on file as a result of the previous emergency use permit and minor use permit processes. And that analysis was to inform the manufacturer of what steps needed to be undertaken or what data gaps needed to be addressed to progress registration. So APVMA, to their credit, actually concluded that process over the Christmas break. They provided advice between Christmas and New Year's. And since that time, that information's been sitting with the manufacturer, who is now looking to come up with a plan to work out what resources and what timelines are required to address those data gaps. We're hopeful that we'll have a sense of direction and some answers from the manufacturer by May, June this year, and then we can start to collectively get visibility of a pathway to registration when we can get it back in growers' pockets.
So you're hopeful to get some of that information from the manufacturer by the middle of this year. When could growers waiting for this vaccine realistically expect it to be on the market by?
Yeah, as far as registration processes go, we'd look to have a plan together, as I said, in May or June, but it would be unrealistic to think that that registration process would conclude in time for the spring, summer 24-25 control season. We'd be turning our view more towards trying to get the registration process concluded so that product is available for the spring, summer 25-26 control season.
That's Adam Dawes, General Manager of Wool Producers Australia, talking foot rot vaccines there before we finish on the Country Hour. For today, let's bring you some news from the courtroom. A Mildura wine company and its manager has been fined almost $500,000 for illegally tapping into a pipeline and stealing water. David Latouré and Jindalee Road Wines, the company he managed at the time, faced the New South Wales Land and Environment Court this week, charged with illegally taking around 365 megalitres of water valued at more than $300,000. The legal action was brought by the Natural Resources Access Regulator, NRA, and here's Investigations and Enforcement Director Lisa Stockley.
This is our 38th prosecution that we have commenced since NRA was formed in 2018. And it is significant because it's the largest total fine that's actually been handed down in an NRA prosecution.
And talk me through what that financial penalty was actually for.
Yeah, so this is actually the first time that we have prosecuted offences under Section 342 and 343 of the Water Management Act, which relate to the interference with public or private works and taking water from public or private works. So first prosecution of that nature. And in relation to the offences, the court handed down a penalty for the company involved of $326,500. And in relation to the former vineyard manager involved in the conduct, $172,500. And that's in addition to the payment of court costs of $95,000. So quite almost $500,000 in fines, quite a significant penalty imposed by the court in relation to this very serious offence under the Water Management Act.
And the nature of the offending, this vineyard manager essentially excavated the Water Authority's pipelines, bypassed water meters so that he was able to take irrigation water without it being metered and therefore not having to pay for it?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Angus. There was pipes that were used to tap into the main supply line, which is owned by Western Murray Irrigation, so it could bypass the metering equipment, which was operated via valve downstream of WMI's outlet meters. So the pipes were buried underground and it allowed the unmetered water take to be used for irrigation over a period of years without detection. The offending period actually was between 2016 and 2019 at two separate vineyards, but it didn't come to light until March 2020 when Western Murray Irrigation detected anomalies in their meter readings and did some further inquiries and uncovered tampering, which they then reported to NRA in March of 2020. We then commenced a very painstaking investigation to gather the evidence that we have put before the court in this prosecution.
And we're 4 years on from that discovery. Is that just how long it takes for these processes to play out?
Yes, the investigation of water take offences is very complex. It does take quite a significant period of time to get the standard of evidence to put before the court, and the prosecution process itself takes quite a period of time. So we commenced this prosecution in April 2023. However, the judgment was only handed down yesterday.
That is the Natural Resources Access Regulator, NRA, Director of Investigations and Enforcement, Lisa Stockley, speaking there with Angus Verley. It's about all the time we have for you on the Country. I did want to make time just to read a few more of your texts on how old your fire truck is and how you feel you're prepared in your region for major fires. There's some interesting thoughts there. Just before we do, though, we will be at Riola on Monday. Angus and I at Riola at the Charity Carnival on Easter Monday for a broadcast for the Country Hour. We're trying out some new equipment, so hopefully we can get our broadcast out from Riola to you, but it should be a lot of fun. And if you are heading to the Charity Carnival, come over and say g'day to both Angus and I. It'll be great to see you and great to have a chat to you there. So that's Easter Monday for the Country Hour. Stay tuned for that. A couple of your texts just before we go on fire trucks. Hi, Warwick. Nairn fire truck is 33 years old. Two trucks in our group are over 35 years old, says this text. Sean, though, says, hi, Warwick. To play devil's advocate, our number two tanker is old enough for club plates, but still fantastic as a truck. And as captain of our brigade, I don't see the point of trading it up for something not as good. Food for thought. Love devil's advocate comments, Sean, on the program. You're always welcome to provide them. How many Ks would have these old fire trucks done, I wonder, says another text here. And John says it's a really good question about fire trucks and really good answers. What's government doing? They're supposed to be looking after our houses and safety, which is obviously not being considered. The thoughts from John in Smythedale for you. Thank you for all of your thoughts coming in on the program today. Sorry I didn't get to them all. Got to as many as I could. We'll be back with you on Monday from Riola. Hope you can join us.